himself, his clothes, his manner, his carriage, as a grand joke. There was a dull pain at his wrists and his feet, and he was finding it harder and harder to breathe. There was nothing more to be gained by feigning unconsciousness, and he raised his head as best he could and spat a gob of scarlet blood onto Mr. Vandemar's face. It was a brave thing to do, he thought, and a stupid one. Perhaps they would have let him die quietly if he had not done that. Now, he had no doubt, they would hurt him more, and perhaps his death would come the quicker for it. The open kettle was boiling fiercely. Richard watched the bubbling water and the thick steam and wondered what they were going to do with it. His imagination was able to provide any number of answers, most of which would have been unimaginably painful, none of which turned out to be correct. The boiling water was poured into a pot, to which Brother Philigenus added 3 spoons of dried, shredded leaves. The resultant liquid was poured from the pot through a tea strainer into 3 china cups. The abbot raised his blind head, sniffed the air, and smiled. "The first part of the ordeal of the key," he said, "is the nice cup of tea. Do you take sugar?"
No, thank you," said Richard warily.
Brother Philigenus added a little milk to the tea and passed a cup and saucer to Richard.
"Is it poisoned?" he asked.
The abbot looked almost offended.
"Good gracious, no."
Richard sipped the tea, which tasted more or less exactly like tea always tasted.
"But this is part of the ordeal."
Brother Philigenus took the abbot's hands and placed a cup of tea in them.
"In a manner of speaking," said the abbot, "we always like to give the seekers a cup of tea before they start. Part of the ordeal for us, not for you."
He sipped his own tea, and a beatific smile spread across his ancient face.
"Rather nice tea, all things considered."
Richard put down his teacup, almost untouched.
"Would you mind then," he asked, "if we just got on with the ordeal?"
"Not at all," said the abbot. "Not at all."
He stood up, and the 3 of them walked towards a door at the far end of the room.
"Is there..."
Richard paused, trying to decide what he was trying to ask. Then he said,
"Is there anything you can tell me about the ordeal?"
The abbot shook his head. There really was nothing to say. He led the seekers to the door, and then he would wait for an hour or two in the corridor outside, and then he would go back in and remove the remains of the seeker from the shrine and inter it in the vaults. And sometimes, which was worse, they would not be dead, although you could not call what was left of them alive. And those unfortunates the Black Friars cared for as best they could.
"Right," said Richard, and he smiled unconvincingly and added, "Well, lead on, Macduff."
Brother Philigenus pulled back the bolts on the door. They opened with a crash, like twin gunshots. He pulled the door open. Richard stepped through it. Brother Philigenus pulled the door closed behind him and swung the bolts back into place. He led the abbot back to his chair and placed the cup of tea back in the old man's hand. The abbot sipped his tea in silence. And then he said, with honest regret in his voice,
It's Leon Macduff, actually, but I hadn't the heart to correct him.
He sounded like such a nice young man."
Chapter 12. Richard Mayhew walked down the underground platform. The sign said Blackfriars. The platform was empty. Somewhere in the distance, an underground train roared and rattled, driving a ghost wind along the platform, which scattered a copy of the tabloid Sun into its component pages, four-color breasts and black-and-white invectives scurrying and tumbling off the platform and down onto the rails. Richard walked the length of the platform. Then he sat down on a bench and waited for something to happen. Nothing happened. He rubbed his head and felt slightly sick. There were footsteps on the platform near him. And he looked up to see a prim little girl walking past him, hand in hand with a woman who looked like a larger, older version of herself. They glanced at him and then, rather obviously, looked away.
"Don't get too near to him, Melanie," advised the woman in a very audible whisper.
Melanie looked at Richard, staring in the way children stare, without embarrassment or self-consciousness. Then she looked back at her mother.
"Why do people like that stay alive?"
she asked, curiously.
"Not enough guts to end it all,"
explained her mother.
Melanie risked another glance at Richard. "Pathetic," she said.
Their feet pattered away down the platform, and soon they were gone. He wondered if he had imagined it. He tried to remember why he was standing on this platform. Was he waiting for a tube train? Where was he going? He knew the answer was somewhere in his head, somewhere close at hand, but he could not touch it, could not bring it back from the lost places. He sat there, alone and wondering. Was he dreaming? With his hands, he felt the hard red plastic seat beneath him, stamped the platform with mud-encrusted shoes. Where had the mud come from? Touched his face. No, this was no dream. Wherever he was real. He felt odd, detached, and depressed, and horribly, strangely saddened. Someone sat down next to him. Richard did not look up, did not turn his head.
"Hello," said a familiar voice. "How are you, Dick? You all right?"
Richard looked up. He felt his face creasing into a smile, hope hitting him like a blow to the chest.
"Gary?"
he asked, scared.
Then, "You can see me."
Gary grinned.
"You always were a kidder,"
he said.
"Funny man, funny."
Gary was wearing a suit and tie. He was clean-shaven and had not a hair out of place. Richard realized what he must look like, muddy, unshaven, rumpled.
"Gary, listen, I know what I must look like. I can explain."
He thought for a moment.
"No, I can't. Not really." "It's okay,"
said Gary, reassuringly. His voice was soothing, sane.
"Not sure how to tell you this. Bit awkward."
He paused.
"Look," he explained, "I'm not really here."
"Yes, you are," said Richard. Gary shook his head sympathetically.
"No," he said, "I'm not. I'm you talking to yourself?"
Richard wondered vaguely if this was one of Gary's jokes.
"Maybe this will help," said Gary. He raised his hands to his face, pushed at it, molded, shaped.
His face oozed like warm silly putty.
"Is that better?"
said the person who had been Gary, in a voice that was jarringly familiar. Richard knew the new face. He had shaved it most weekday mornings since he had left school. He had cleaned its teeth, squeezed its spots, and on occasion wished it looked more like Tom Cruise's or John Lennon's or anyone else's, really. It was, of course, his face.
"You're sitting on Blackfriars Station at rush hour,"
said the other Richard, casually.
"You're talking to yourself. And you know what they say about people who talk to themselves. It's just you're starting to edge a little closer to sanity now."
The damp, muddy Richard stared into the face of the clean, well-dressed Richard, and he said, "I don't know who you are or what you're trying to do, but you aren't even very convincing. You don't even look like me." He was lying, and he knew it. His other self smiled encouragingly and shook his head. "I'm you, Richard," he said. "I'm whatever's left of your sanity." It was not the embarrassing echo of his voice he heard on answering machines, on tapes and home videos, that horrid parody of a voice that passed for his. The man spoke with Richard's true voice, the voice he heard in his head when he spoke, resonant and real. "Concentrate!" shouted the man with Richard's face. "Look at this place. Try to see the people. Try to see the truth. You're already the closest you've been in a week to reality." "This is bullshit," said Richard, flatly, desperately. He shook his head, denying everything his other self was saying. But still, he looked at the platform, wondering what it was he was meant to be seeing. Then something flickered at the corner of his vision. He followed it with his head, but it was gone. "Look," whispered his double. "See." "See what?" He was standing on an empty, dimly lit station platform, a lonely mausoleum of a place. And then the noise and the light struck him like a bottle across the face. He was standing on Blackfriars Station in the middle of the rush hour. People bustled by him, a riot of noise and light, of shoving, moving humanity. There was an underground train waiting at the platform, and reflected in its window, Richard could see himself. He looked crazy. He had a week's growth of beard. Food was crusted around his mouth and in his beard. One eye had recently been blackened, and a boil, an angry red carbuncle, was coming up on the side of his nose. He was filthy, covered in a black, encrusted dirt which filled his pores and lived under his fingernails. His eyes were red and bleary. His hair was matted and snarled. He was a crazy, homeless person, standing on a platform of a busy underground station in the heart of the rush hour. Richard buried his face deep in his hands. When he raised his face, the other people were gone. The platform was dark again, and he was alone. He sat down on a bench and closed his eyes. A hand found his hand, held it for some moments, and then squeezed it. A woman's hand. He could smell a familiar perfume. The other Richard sat on his left. And now Jessica sat on his right, holding his hand in hers, looking at him compassionately. He had never seen that expression on her face before. "Jess?" he said. Jessica shook her head. She let go of his hand. "I'm afraid not," she said. "I'm still you. But you have to listen, darling. You're the closest to reality you've been." "You people keep saying the closest to reality, the closest to sanity. I don't know what you..." He paused. Something came back to him then. He looked at the other version of himself, at the woman he had loved. "Is this part of the ordeal?" he demanded. "Ordeal?" asked Jessica. She exchanged a concerned glance with the other Richard who wasn't him. "Yes, ordeal, with the Black Friars who live under London," Richard said. As he said it, it became more real. "There's a key I have to get for this angel called Islington. If I get him the key, he'll send me home again." His mouth dried up, and he could talk no longer. "Listen to yourself," said the other Richard gently. "Can't you tell how ridiculous all this sounds?" Jessica looked as if she were trying not to cry. Her eyes glistened. "You're not going through an ordeal, Richard. You had some kind of nervous breakdown. A couple of weeks ago, I think you just cracked up. I broke off our engagement. You been acting so strangely. It was like you were a different person. I couldn't cope. Then you vanished.
The tears began to run down her cheeks, and she stopped talking to blow her nose on a tissue. The other Richard began to speak.
I wandered alone and crazy through the streets of London, sleeping under bridges, eating food from bins and skips, shivering and lost and alone, muttering to myself, talking to people who weren't there.
I'm so sorry, Richard, said Jessica. She was crying now, her face contorted and unattractive. Her mascara was beginning to run, and her nose was red. He had never seen her hurting before, and he realized how much he wanted to take her pain away. Richard reached out for her to try to hold her, to comfort and reassure her, but the world slid and twisted and changed. Someone stumbled into him, cursed, and walked away. Richard was lying prone on the platform in the rush hour glare. The side of his face was sticky and cold. He pulled his head up off the ground. He had been lying in a pool of his own vomit. At least he hoped it was his own. Passers-by stared at him with revulsion, or, after one flick of the eyes, did not look at him again. He wiped at his face with his hands and tried to get up, but could no longer remember how. Richard began to whimper. He shut his eyes tightly, and he kept them shut. When he opened them, 30 seconds or an hour or a day later, the platform was in semi-darkness. He climbed to his feet. There was nobody there.
Hello?
He called.
Help me. Please?
Gary was sitting on the bench, watching him.
What, you still need someone to tell you what to do?
Gary got up and walked over to where Richard was standing.
Richard, he said urgently, I'm you.
The only advice I can give you is what you're telling yourself.
Only maybe you're too scared to listen.
You aren't me, said Richard, but he no longer believed it.
Touch me, said Gary.
Richard reached a hand out. His hand pushed into Gary's face, squashing and distorting it as if it were pushing into warm bubble gum. Richard felt nothing in the air around his hand. He pulled his fingers out of Gary's face.
See? Said Gary. I'm not here. All there is you, walking up and down the platform, talking to yourself, trying to get up the courage to...
Richard had not meant to say anything, but his mouth moved and he heard his voice saying,
trying to get up the courage to do what?
A deep voice came over the loudspeaker and echoed, distorted, down the platform.
London Transport would like to apologize for the delay. This is due to an incident at Blackfriars Station.
To do that, said Gary, inclining his head. Become an incident at Blackfriars Station. To end it all.
Your life's a joyless, loveless, empty sham. You've got no friends.
I've got you, whispered Richard.
Gary appraised Richard with frank eyes.
I think you're an arsehole, he said, honestly. A complete joke. I've got Dor and Hunter and Anesthesia.
Gary smiled. There was real pity in the smile. And it hurt Richard more than hatred or enmity could ever have done.
More imaginary friends. We all used to laugh at you round the office for those trolls. Remember them? On your desk?
He laughed. Richard started to laugh too. It was all too horrible. There was nothing else to do but laugh. After some time, he stopped laughing. Gary put his hand into his pocket and produced a small plastic troll. It had frizzy purple hair, and it had once sat on the top of Richard's computer screen.
Here,
said Gary. He tossed the troll to Richard.
Richard tried to catch it, He reached out his hands, but it fell through them as if they were not there. He went down onto his hands and knees on the empty platform, fumbling for the troll. It seemed to him, then, as if it were the only fragment he had of his real life, that if he could only get the troll back, perhaps he could get everything back. Flash. It was rush hour again. A train disgorged hundreds of people onto the platform, and hundreds of others tried to get on, and Richard was down on his hands and knees being kicked and buffeted by the commuters. Somebody stepped on his fingers, hard. He screamed shrilly and stuck his fingers into his mouth instinctively, like a burned child. They tasted disgusting. He did not care. He could see the troll at the platform's edge, now only 10 feet away, and he crawled slowly on all fours through the crowd across the platform. People swore at him. They got in his way. They buffeted him. He had never imagined that 10 feet could be such a long distance to travel. Richard heard a high-pitched voice giggling as he crawled, and he wondered who it could belong to. It was a disturbing giggle, nasty and strange. He wondered what manner of crazy person could giggle like that. He swallowed, and the giggling stopped, and then he knew. He was almost at the edge of the platform. An elderly woman stepped onto the train, and as she did so, her foot knocked the purple-haired troll down into the darkness, down into the gap between the train and the platform. "No," said Richard. He was still laughing, an awkward, wheezing laugh, but tears stung his eyes and spilled down his cheeks. He rubbed his eyes with his hands, making them sting even more. Flash! The platform was deserted and dark again. He climbed to his feet and walked unsteadily the last few feet to the edge of the platform. He could see it down there, down on the tracks by the third rail, a small splash of purple, his troll. He looked ahead of him. There were enormous posters stuck to the wall on the other side of the tracks. The posters advertised credit cards and sports shoes and holidays in Cyprus. As he looked, the words on the posters twisted and mutated. New messages. "End it all," was one of them. "Put yourself out of your misery. Be a man. Do yourself in. Have a fatal accident today." He nodded. He was talking to himself. The posters did not really say that. Yes, he was talking to himself, and it was time that he listened. He could hear the rattling of a train not far away, coming towards the station. Richard clenched his teeth and swayed back and forth as if he were still being buffeted by commuters, although he was alone on the platform. The train was coming towards him, its headlights shining out from the tunnel like the eyes of a monstrous dragon in a childhood nightmare. And he understood then just how little effort it would take to make the pain stop, to take all the pain he ever had had, all the pain he ever would have, and make it all go away forever and ever. He pushed his hands deep into his pockets and took a deep breath. It would be so easy. A moment of pain, and then it would all be over and done. There was something in his pocket. He felt it with his fingers, something smooth and hard and roughly spherical. He pulled it out of his pocket and examined it, a quartz bead. He remembered picking it up then. He had been on the far side of Knight's Bridge. The bead had been part of Anesthesia's necklace. And from somewhere in his head or out of it, he thought he heard the rat girl say, "Richard, hold on." He did not know if there was anyone helping him at that moment. He suspected that he was truly talking to himself, that this was the real him speaking, and he was finally listening. He nodded and put the bead back into his pocket, and he stood on the platform and waited for the train to come in. It arrived at the platform, slowed, came to a full stop. The train doors hissed open. The carriage was filled with every manner and kind of people, all of whom were, unmistakably, quite dead. There were fresh corpses with ragged cuts in their throats or bullet holes in their temples. There were old, desiccated bodies. There were strap-hanging cadavers covered with cobwebs and messy, cancerous things lolling in their seats. Each corpse seemed, as much as one could tell, to have died by its own hand. Some were male and some were female. Richard thought he had seen some of those faces pinned to a long wall, but he could no longer remember where he had seen them, could not remember when. The carriage smelled like a morgue might do at the end of a long, hot summer, during the course of which the refrigeration equipment had failed for good. Richard had no idea who he was anymore. No idea what was or what was not true, nor whether he was brave or cowardly, mad or sane. But he knew the next thing he had to do. He stepped onto the train, and all the lights went out. The bolts were drawn back. Two loud bangs echoed through the room. The door to the tiny shrine was pushed open, letting in lamplight from the hall outside. It was a small room with a high arched ceiling. A silver key hung from a thread attached to the highest point of the ceiling. The wind caused by the opening of the door made the key swing back and forth and then spin slowly, first one way and then the other. The abbot held Brother Philigenus's arm, and the two men walked into the shrine side by side. Then the abbot let go of the brother's arm and said, "Take the body, Brother Philigenus." But, Father, what is it? Brother Philigenus went down on one knee. The abbot could hear fingers against cloth and skin. "He's not dead." The abbot sighed. It was an evil thing to think, he knew, but he honestly felt it was so much kinder if they died outright. This was so much worse. "One of those, hey?" he said. "Ah, well, we will look after the poor creature until it passes on to its ultimate reward. Lead it to the infirmary." And a weak voice said, quietly, but firmly, "I am not a poor creature." The abbot heard someone stand up, heard Brother Philigenus's sharp intake of breath. I think I got through it," said Richard Mayhew's voice, suddenly uncertain. "Unless this is more of the ordeal." "No, my son," said the abbot. There was something in his voice that might have been awe and might have been regret. There was silence. I think I will have that cup of tea now, if you don't mind," said Richard.
"Of course," said the abbot. "This way."
Richard stared at the old man. The glaucous eyes gazed out at nothing at all. He seemed pleased that Richard was alive, but...
"Excuse me, sir," said Brother Philigenus respectfully to Richard, breaking his train of thought. "Don't forget your key."
"Oh, yes. Thanks." He had forgotten about the key. He reached out and closed his hand upon the cold silver key, rotating slowly on its thread. He tugged, and the thread snapped easily. Richard opened his hand, and the key stared up at him from his palm.
"By my crooked teeth," asked Richard, remembering, "who am I?"
He put it in his pocket, next to the small quartz bead, and together they left that place. The fog had begun to thin. Hunter was pleased. She was confident now that, should it become necessary, she could get the lady door away from the friars entirely unharmed, and get herself away with only minor flesh wounds. There was a flurry of movement on the far side of the bridge.
"Something's happening," said Hunter to Dor, under her breath. "Get ready to make a run for it."
The friars drew back. Richard Mayhew, the upworlder, came towards them through the fog, walking beside the abbot. Richard looked different, somehow. Hunter scrutinized him, trying to work out what had changed. His center of balance had moved lower, become more centered. No, it was more than that. He looked less boyish. He looked as if he had begun to grow up.
"Still alive, then?" said Hunter.
He nodded, put his hand into his pocket, and pulled out a silver key. He tossed it to Dor, who caught it, then flung herself at him, wrapping her arms around him, squeezing him as tightly as she could. Then Dor let go of Richard and ran to the abbot.
"I can't tell you how much this means to us," she said to him.
He smiled, weakly but graciously.
"May the temple and the arch be with you all on your journey through the underside," he said.
Dor curtsied, and then, clutching the key tightly in her hand, she went back to Richard and to Hunter. The three travellers walked down the bridge and away. The friars stood on the bridge until they were out of sight, lost in the old fog of the world beneath the world.
"We have lost the key," said the abbot to himself, as much as to any of them. "God help us all."
Chapter 13. The angel Islington was dreaming a dark and rushing dream. Huge waves were rising and crashing over the city. The night sky was rent with forks of white lightning from horizon to horizon. The rain fell in sheets. The city trembled. Fires started near the great amphitheatre and spread quickly through the city, defying the storm. Islington was looking down on everything from far above, hovering in the air as one hovers in dreams, as it had hovered in those long-ago times. There were buildings in that city that were many hundreds of feet high, but they were dwarfed by the grey-green Atlantic waves. And then it heard the people scream. There were 4 million people in Atlantis, and in its dream Islington heard each and every one of their voices clearly and distinctly, as one by one they screamed and choked and burned and drowned and died. The waves swallowed the city, and at length, the storm subsided. When dawn broke, there was nothing to indicate there had ever been a city there at all, let alone an island twice the size of Greece. Nothing of Atlantis remained but the water-bloated bodies of children, of women and of men, floating on the cold morning waves, bodies at which the seagulls, grey and white, were already beginning to pick with their cruel beaks. And Islington woke. It was standing in the octagon of iron pillars, beside the great black door made of flint and tarnished silver. It touched the cold smoothness of the flint, the chill of the metal. It touched the table. It ran its finger lightly along the walls. Then it walked through the chambers of its hall, one after another, touching things, as if to reassure itself of their existence, to convince itself it was here and now. It followed patterns as it walked, smooth channels its bare feet had worn over the centuries in the rock. It stopped when it reached the rock pool, kneeling down and letting its fingers touch the cold water. There was a ripple in the water, which began with its fingertips and echoed out to the edges. The reflections in the pool, of the angel itself and the candle flames that framed it, shimmered and transformed. It was looking into a cellar. The angel concentrated for a moment. It could hear a telephone ring somewhere in the distance. Mr. Krupp walked over to the telephone and picked up the handpiece. He looked rather pleased with himself.
"Krupp and Vandemar," he barked. "Eyes gouged, noses twisted, tongues pierced, chins cleft, throats slit."
"Mr. Krupp," said the angel, "they now have the key. I want the girl called Dor kept safe on her journey back to me."
"Safe,"
repeated Mr. Krupp, unimpressed.
"Right. We'll keep her safe. What a marvellous idea. Such originality. Positively astounding. Most people would be content with hiring assassins for executions, sly killings, vile murders even. Only you, sir, would hire the two finest cutthroats in the whole of space and time and then ask them to ensure a little girl remains unharmed."
"See that she is, Mr. Krupp. Nothing is to hurt her. Permit her to be harmed in any way, and you will displease me deeply. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
Krupp shifted uncomfortably. "Is there anything else?" asked Islington.
"Yes, sir."
Krupp coughed into his hand.
"Do you remember the Marquis de Carabas?"
"Of course."
"I take it that there is no such similar prohibition on extirpating the Marquis?"
"Not any longer," said the angel. "Just protect the girl." It removed its hand from the water. The reflection was now merely candle flames and an angel of astonishing, perfectly androgynous beauty. The angel Islington stood up and returned to its inner chambers to await its eventual visitors.
"What did he say?"
asked Mr. Vandemar.
"He said, Mr. Vandemar, that we should feel free to do whatsoever we wished to the Marquis."
Vandemar nodded.
"Did that include killing him painfully?" he asked, a little pedantically.
"Yes, Mr. Vandemar, I would say, on reflection, it did."
"That's good, Mr. Krupp. Wouldn't like another telling off."
He looked up at the bloody thing hanging above them.
"Better get rid of the body, then."
One of the front wheels on the supermarket shopping cart squeaked and had a pronounced tendency to pull to the left. Mr. Vandemar had found the metal cart on a grassed-in traffic island near the hospital. It was, he had realized on seeing it, just the right size for moving a body. He could have carried the body, of course, but then it could have bled on him or dripped other fluids. And he only had the one suit. So he pushed the shopping cart with the body of the Marquis de Carabas in it through the storm drain, and it went squee, squee, and pulled to the left. He wished that Mr. Krupp would push the shopping cart for a change. But Mr. Krupp was talking.
"You know, Mr. Vandemar,"
he was saying,
"I am currently too overjoyed, too delighted, not to mention too utterly and illimitably ecstatic to grouse, gripe, or grumble, having finally been permitted to do what we do best."
Mr. Vandemar negotiated a particularly awkward corner
Kill someone, you mean? He asked. Mr. Croup beamed.
Kill someone, I mean, indeed, Mr. Vandemar, brave soul, glittering noble fellow. However, by now, you must have sensed a lurking but skulking beneath my happy, blithe and chipper exterior, a minuscule vexation like the teeniest lump of raw liver sticking to the inside of my boot. You must, I have no doubt, be saying to yourself, all is not well in Mr. Croup's breast. I shall induce him to unburden himself to me.
Mr. Vandemar pondered this, while he forced open the round iron door between the storm drain and the sewer, and clambered through. Then he manhandled the wire cart with the Marquis de Carabas's body in it through the doorway. And then, more or less certain that he had been thinking nothing of the sort, he said, "No." Mr. Croup ignored this and continued.
"And were I then, in response to your pleadings, to divulge to you what vexes me, I would confess that my soul is irked by the necessity to hide our light under a bushel. We should be hanging the former Marquis's sad remains from the highest gibbet in London below, not tossing it away like a used..."
He paused, searching for the exact simile. "Rat," suggested Mr. Vandemar. "Budgerigar," "spleen," "squee, squee," went the wheels of the shopping cart. Mr. Croup did not like any of them.
"Ah, well," he said.
In front of them was a deep channel of brown water. Drifting on the water's surface were off-white suds of foam, used condoms, and occasional fragments of toilet paper. Mr. Vandemar stopped the shopping cart. Mr. Croup leaned down and picked up the Marquis's head by the hair and hissed into its dead ear.
"The sooner this business is over and done with, the happier I'll be. There's other times and other places that will properly appreciate two pair of dab hands with the garrotting wire and the boning knife."
And then he stood up.
"Good night, good Marquis. Don't forget to write."
Mr. Vandemar tipped over the cart, and the Marquis's corpse tumbled out and splashed into the brown water below them. And then, because he had come to dislike it intensely, Mr. Vandemar pushed the shopping cart into the sewer as well and watched the current carry it away. Then Mr. Croup held his lamp up high and he stared up at the place in which they stood.
"It is saddening to reflect," said Mr. Croup, "that there are folk walking the streets above who will never know the beauty of these sewers, Mr. Vandemar. These red brick cathedrals beneath their feet."
"Craftsmanship," agreed Mr. Vandemar. They turned their backs on the brown water and made their way back into the tunnels.
"With cities as with people, Mr. Vandemar," said Mr. Croup fastidiously, "the condition of the bowels is all important."
Dor tied the key around her neck with a piece of string that she found in one of the pockets of her leather jacket. "That's not going to be safe," said Richard. The girl made a face at him.
"Well," he said, "it's not."
She shrugged.
"Okay,"
she said. "I'll get a chain for it when we get to the market." They were walking through a maze of caves, deep tunnels hacked from the limestone that, to Richard, felt almost prehistoric. Richard chuckled.
"What's so funny?"
Dor asked. He grinned.
"I was just thinking of the expression on the Marquis's face when we tell him we got the key from the friars, without his help."
"I'm sure he'll have something sardonic to say about it," she said. And then, back to the angel, by the long and dangerous way, whatever that is. Richard found himself about to say,
"I'm sure it'll be long and dangerous,"
and made himself not say it. Instead, he admired the paintings on the cave walls. Russets and ochres and siennas outlined charging boars and fleeing gazelles, woolly mastodons and giant sloths. He imagined that the paintings had to be thousands of years old, but then they turned a corner, and he noticed that, in the same style, there were lorries, house cats, cars, and, markedly inferior to the other images, as if only glimpsed infrequently and from a long way away, airplanes. None of the paintings were very high off the ground. He wondered if the painters were a race of subterranean Neanderthal pygmies. It was as likely as anything else in this strange world.
"So where is the next market?" he asked.
"No idea," said Dor.
"Hunter?"
Hunter slipped out of the shadows. "I don't know." A small figure dashed past them, going back the way they had come. A few moments later, another couple of tiny figures came towards them in fell pursuit. Hunter whipped out a hand as they passed, snagging a small boy by the ear.
"Ow!"
he said, in the manner of small boys.
"Let me go! She stole my paintbrush!" "That's right,"
said a piping voice from further down the corridor.
"She did!" "I didn't!"
came an even higher and more piping voice from even further down the corridor. Hunter pointed to the paintings on the cave wall.
"You did these?"
she asked. The boy had the towering arrogance only seen in the greatest of artists and all 9-year-old boys.
"Yeah,"
he said truculently. "Some of them."
"Not bad,"
said Hunter. The boy glared at her.
"Where's the next floating market?"
asked Dor.
"Belfast,"
said the boy.
"Tonight."
"Thanks," said Dor. "Hope you get your paintbrush back. Let him go, Hunter." Hunter let go of the boy's ear. He did not move. He looked up and down, then made a face to indicate that he was, without any question at all, unimpressed.
"You're Hunter?"
he asked. She smiled down at him modestly. He sniffed.
"You're the best bodyguard in the underside."
"So they tell me." The boy reached one hand back and forward again in one smooth movement. He stopped, puzzled, and opened his hand, examined his palm. Then he looked up at Hunter, confused. Hunter opened her hand to reveal a small flick knife with a wicked blade. She held it up out of the boy's reach. He wrinkled his nose.
"How'd you do that?"
"Scram," said Hunter. She closed the knife and tossed it back to the boy, who took off down the corridor without a backward glance in pursuit of his paintbrush. The body of the Marquis de Carabas drifted east through the deep sewer, face down. London sewers had begun their lives as rivers and streams, flowing north to south and south of the Thames, south to north, carrying garbage, animal carcasses, and the contents of chamber pots into the Thames, which would, if it felt like it, carry the offending substances out to sea. This system had more or less worked for many years, until, in 1858, the enormous volume of effluent produced by the people and industries of London, combined with a rather hot summer, produced a phenomenon known at the time as the Great Stink. The Thames itself had become an open sewer. People who could leave London left it. The ones who stayed wrapped cloths doused in carbolic around their faces and tried not to breathe through their noses. Parliament was forced to recess early in 1858, and the following year it ordered that a program of sewer building begin. The thousands of miles of sewers that were built were constructed with a gentle slope from the west to the east. And somewhere beyond Greenwich they were pumped into the Thames estuary, and the sewage was swept off into the North Sea. It was this journey that the body of the late Marquis de Carabas was making, travelling west to east towards the sunrise and the sewage works. Rats on a high brick ledge, doing the things that rats do when no people are watching, saw the body go by. The largest of them, a big black male, chittered. A smaller brown female chittered back. Then she leapt down from the ledge onto the Marquis's back and rode it down the sewer a little way, sniffing at the hair and the coat, tasting the blood, and then precariously leaning over and scrutinizing what could be seen of the face. She hopped off the head into the filthy water and swam industriously to the side, where she clambered up the slippery brickwork. She hurried back along the beam and rejoined her companions.
"Belfast?" asked Richard.
Dor smiled impishly and would say nothing more than, "You'll see," when he pressed her about it. He changed his tack.
"How do you know that kid was telling you the truth about the market?"
he asked.
"It's not something anyone down here ever lies about. I don't think we can lie about it."
She paused.
"The market's special." "How did that kid know where it was?"
"Someone told him," said Hunter. Richard brooded on this for a moment.
"How did they know?"
"Someone told them," explained Dor.
"But..."
He wondered who chose the locations in the first place, how the knowledge was spread, trying to frame the question in such a way that he did not sound stupid. A rich female voice asked from the darkness,
"Hss! Any idea when the next market is?"
She stepped into the light. She wore silver jewellery, and her dark hair was perfectly coiffed. She was very pale, and her long dress was jet black velvet. Richard knew immediately that he had seen her before, but it took him a few moments to place her. The first floating market, that was it, in Harrods. She had smiled at him.
"Tonight," said Hunter. "Belfast."
"Thank you," said the woman. She had the most amazing eyes, thought Richard. They were the colour of foxgloves.
"I'll see you there,"
she said, and she looked at Richard as she said it. Then she looked away, a little shyly. She stepped into the shadows and she was gone.
"Who was that?"
asked Richard.
"They call themselves Velvets," said Dor. "They sleep down here during the day and walk the upworld at night."
"Are they dangerous?" asked Richard.
"Everybody's dangerous," said Hunter.
"Look," said Richard,
"going back to the market, who decides where it gets held and when, and how do the first people find out where it's being held?"
Hunter shrugged.
"Dor?"
he asked.
"I've never thought about it."
They turned a corner. Dor held up her lamp.
"Not bad at all,"
said Dor.
"And fast, too,"
said Hunter. She touched the painting on the rock wall with her fingertip. The paint was still wet. It was a painting of Hunter and Dor and Richard. It was not flattering. The black rat entered the lair of the golden, deferentially, his head lowered, ears back. He crawled forward, squeeing and chittering. The golden had made their lair in a pile of bones. This pile of bones had once belonged to a woolly mammoth, back in the cold times when the great hairy beasts walked across the snowy tundra of the south of England as if, in the opinion of the golden, they owned the place. This particular mammoth, at least, had been disabused of that idea rather thoroughly and quite terminally by the golden. The black rat made its obeisance at the base of the bone pile. Then he lay on his back with his throat exposed, closed his eyes and waited. After a while a chittering from above told him that he could roll over. One of the golden crawled out of the mammoth's skull on the top of the heap of bones. It crawled along the old ivory tusk, a golden-furred rat with copper-coloured eyes, the size of a large house cat. The black rat spoke. The golden thought, briefly, and chattered an order. The black rat rolled on his back, exposing his throat again for a moment. then a twist and a wriggle, and he was on his way. There had been sewer folk before the Great Stink, of course, living in the Elizabethan sewers, or the Restoration sewers, or the Regency sewers, as more and more of London's waterways were forced into pipes and covered passages, as the expanding population produced more filth, more rubbish, more effluent. After the great program of Victorian sewer building, that was when they came into their own. They could be found anywhere in the length and breadth of the sewers, but they made their permanent homes in some of the church-like red brick vaults towards the east, at the confluence of many of the churning, foamy waters. There they would sit, rods and nets and improvised hooks beside them, and watch the surface of the brown water. They wore clothes, brown and green clothes, covered in a thick layer of something that might have been mould, and might have been a petrochemical ooze, and might, conceivably, have been something much worse. They wore their hair long and matted. They smelled more or less as one would imagine. Old storm lanterns were hung about the tunnel. Nobody knew what the sewer folk used for fuel, but their lanterns burned with a rather noxious blue and green flame. It was not known how the sewer folk communicated amongst themselves. In their few dealings with the outside world, they used a kind of dumb show. They lived in a world of gurgles and drips, the men, the women, and the silent little sewer children. Dunnikin spotted something in the water. He was the chief of the sewer folk, the wisest and the oldest. He knew the sewers better than their original builders. Dunnikin reached for a long shrimping net. One practiced hand movement, and he was fishing out a rather bedraggled mobile telephone from the water. He walked over to a small heap of rubbish in the corner and put the telephone down with the rest of their haul. The day's catch so far consisted of 2 odd gloves, a shoe, a cat skull, a copy of Fiesta, a sodden packet of cigarettes, an artificial leg, a dead cocker spaniel, a pair of antlers, mounted, and the bottom half of a perambulator. It had not been a good day. And tonight was a market night in the open air. So Dunnikin kept his eyes on the water. You never knew what would turn up. Old Bailey was hanging his washing out to dry. Blankets and sheets fluttered and blew in the wind on the top of Centre Point, the ugly and distinctive 60s skyscraper that marks the eastern end of Oxford Street, far above Tottenham Court Road station. Old Bailey did not care very much for Centre Point itself, but, as he'd often told the birds, the view from the top was without compare. And, furthermore, the top of Centre Point was one of the few places in the West End of London where you did not have to look at Centre Point itself. The wind ripped feathers from Old Bailey's coat and blew them away, off over London. He did not mind. As he often told his birds, there were more where those came from. A large black rat crawled out through a ripped air vent cover, looked around, then came over to Old Bailey's bird-spattered tent. It ran up the side of the tent, then along the top of Old Bailey's washing line. It squealed at him, urgently.
"Slower, slower," said Old Bailey.
The rat repeated itself, at a lower pitch, but just as urgently.
"Bless me,"
said Old Bailey. He ran into his tent and returned with weapons, his toasting fork and a coal shovel. Then he hurried back into the tent again and came out with some bargaining tools. And then he walked back into the tent for the last time and opened his wooden chest and pocketed the silver box.
"I really don't have time for this tomfoolery," he told the rat on his final exit from the tent. "I'm a very busy man. Birds don't catch themselves, you know."
The rat squeaked at him. Old Bailey was unfastening the coil of rope around his middle.
"Well," he told the rat, "there's others could get the body. I'm not as young as I was. I don't like the underplaces. I'm a roof man, I am, born and bred."
The rat made a rude noise.
"More haste, less speed. replied Old Bailey. I'm going, young whippersnapper. I knew your great-great-grandfather, young Felomy Rat, so don't you try putting on airs. Now, where's the Marquis?